Let's open our Bibles together then to Matthew, the 19th chapter. Matthew, the 19th chapter, and I'm going to read verses 3 through 12. The Pharisees also came to him, testing him and saying to him, "Is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for just any reason?" And he answered and said to them, "Have you not read that he who made them at the beginning made them male and female, and said, 'For this reason a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh.' So then they are no longer two, but one flesh. Therefore what God has joined together, let not man separate." They said to him, "Why then did Moses command to give a certificate of divorce and to put her away?" He said to them, "Moses, because of the hardness of your hearts, permitted you to divorce your wives, but from the beginning it was not so. And I say to you, whosoever divorces his wife except for sexual immorality and marries another commits adultery. And whoever marries her who is divorced commits adultery." His disciples said to him, "If such is the case of man with his wife, it is better not to marry." But he said to them, "All cannot accept this saying, but only those to whom it has been given. For there are eunuchs who were born thus from their mother's womb, and there are eunuchs who were made eunuchs by men, and there are eunuchs who have made themselves eunuchs for the kingdom of heaven's sake. He who is able to accept it, let him accept it." The matter of divorce is something that has touched probably the lives of everyone in the audience, either by having gone through it or having a child, parents, some close family member, some close friend. It has affected elders in congregations. It has affected preachers in congregations. It has affected all of us in one way or another. And therefore, it's important that we understand what the Scriptures say about this matter. Because what we'll find both from Jesus' words today, and if we were to look at the other half dozen passages, what we would clearly see is that God is not ambivalent about it. God has not taken a hands-off approach and said, "Well, you do what you want to do when it comes to your marriages and the problems that you face in the marriage." And so we understand that it is relevant to us as we deal with the question within either our own personal lives or in the lives of our loved ones. Let's begin first of all by examining this matter and just looking at what was behind the Pharisees and their questioning here. It's getting toward the end of Jesus' ministry, and what they're really wanting to do is look for opportunities to ensnare Jesus. They want to pit Jesus against his popular support. And so they'll try a number of things throughout those last months in particular to pose questions that are intended to trip him up. And this, quite frankly, was just such a question, because what they were hoping to do was to get him to come down on one side or the other of a couple of very popular or the most popular views within Jerusalem and Judaism at that time. One of the most popular views that was being held was by those who were of a very conservative school, the Shemaiah, who said that what you're going to deal with is the idea of divorce is something that's to be taken very seriously. And when you go back into the old law and read, you find that it's going to be because of adultery. And so they would look at things that talked about the idea of indecency in Deuteronomy and say, that's adultery. And therefore, they said, that's the only reason you can get a divorce. Now, the Hillel group is a larger group of rabbi scholars who came to the conclusion, and they had a very liberal view, and said, no, the idea of indecency meant if your wife upsets you, so that you could divorce her for anything that might upset you, and that therefore was an indecent thing. If she said things in certain ways that would upset you, it's indecent. You can put her away. If she were to behave in certain ways and it upsets you, that's indecent, and you can put her away. Oh, and of course the adultery question comes into play as well. So you see, what those two camps presented were two really extreme views. And while there were lesser groups in Judaism at that time, they were the ruling attitudes. And there was nothing the Jewish leaders, nothing the Pharisees wanted more than for Jesus to go to one camp or the other, and therefore put himself out there to create controversy within one group or the other. Now, the real target here was the idea of also getting at the very teachings of John the Baptist. If they could get him to oppose what John seemed to have done when he approached Herod about the marriage of Herodias, and then if you'll remember, that really led to John's beheading, then what they would do is be successful, because they could turn the teachings of Jesus against that man, John the Baptist, that was still very popular among them. Or if they could side with the more conservative view, then the masses of people who had liked the halal view, they would say, that's wonderful. He's now in opposition to everybody else on the question of divorce and remarriage. So the intent wasn't that the Pharisees were trying to say, we're dealing with this. Jesus, you've shown yourself to be so wise. Give us some insights as to what's going on here. Give us some insights so that we might know what to do when we deal with this matter of divorce. So what they really wanted to know was, is divorce permissible in anything, under any circumstance? What are we going to do? Well, what we find is that Jesus, in all of his wisdom, trips them up within their own questions. Rather than getting into the current controversy between the two rabbinical laws or lines of thought, rather than getting into what did Moses mean, what we find in the reading is quite simply this. Let's go back and look again, beginning at verse 4. Have you not read that he who made them in the beginning made them male and female? So here we are in the current time in the first century as we know it, with all the controversial swirling around what Moses had taught and presented to the people hundreds and hundreds of years ago, 1,000 years ago, plus. Jesus says, no. Let's go back to the beginning. Let's go back to Genesis. Let's see what God said in Genesis 1 and 2. And so he bypasses the current controversy. He bypasses the law of Moses, in a sense, and he goes back to saying, what did God do in the beginning? What God did in the beginning was simply say, here is what you have. You're joined together as one flesh. That's the reason of leaving father and mother and being joined to the spouse. Jesus then calls to witness, not Moses, but the beginning. And in doing so, I believe he has set both of those schools of thought of that day, he has set them aside, and doesn't make them a part of the controversy. He's not going to be trapped into either group, into either ways of thinking about it. Somebody once said this, and I think it's interesting to consider. Adam and Eve were created for each other and for no one else. Their union was necessarily complete and unbreakable. So, there's no technical arguing of, well, it was just Adam and Eve. Who were they going to commit adultery with? No, the point is, God sets that as an example of the exclusivity that arises when we find ourselves in this marriage union. And then he goes on to make the point in verse 6, so then they were no longer two, but one flesh. Therefore, what God has joined together, let no man separate. What do we get from this point? We get from this point, quite simply, it's a union, a joining together. And as I've shared with you over the last few years, I think it's important to latch on to that idea of join together. Because we are, as a society, moving into a very muddied term for marriage. That process has been going on for a long time. But it's going to get worse when at some point homosexual marriages will be recognized nationally. So do we take the word marriage as used in the context of American society and try to make application to reading our Bibles? If we do, I think we create a great deal of confusion. But if we take the term and expression of what God has joined together, if we talk about a God-joined union, then all marriages need to be understood in light of a God-joined union. What that lets us do very quickly and very immediately is this. The man who's married to the man, the woman who's married to the woman in the laws of this state of a state in the union, or eventually in the United States, he's not in a God-joined union. They've got a piece of paper that may look just like your piece of paper that says you're married. But it's not a God-joined union. The individual who has three or four wives, it may come to the point where polygamy is reinstituted as something that's not illegal. But they will not be God-joined unions, though each of them may have a license suggesting that they're married. It may be that two adulterers leave their spouses and go join and become married in the sight of the laws of the land. They'll have a certificate just like you and I have, but it will not be a God-joined union. It will be a civil union, just as all of our marriages are civil unions, but what we're interested in is that God-joined union. And the idea of a union here is the idea of a yoke. It is the idea of a putting together to accomplish that which God wants accomplished. And so they are within this God-joined union. I think it tells us a couple of other things as we look at this sense of the union. And one is the obligations that are presented. The obligation in order to enter that yoke is to leave the freedom that we had before we went into the yoke. It is to leave the obligations and responsibilities we had within our parents' home. That's why they leave father and mother and are joined, yoked to their spouse. And I think the other thing, and I alluded to it a moment ago, is that this idea of the yoke also presents not only the obligation, but the idea that there are restraints as well. Yoked together with our spouse means that we don't go off after someone else. If you stay in your yoke and try to go off after someone else, the partner is resisting, if they're godly, they're resisting that. And it keeps us restrained. I think there's also within that sense the idea of a permanency in God's eyes as well. So we need to recognize and establish within our minds that what we're talking about is, as we look at any marriage, and I don't want to be using air quotes all day. As we look at any marriage, just ask yourself, is it a God-joined union? What we find also within our text here in Matthew 19 is that God did not want separation. Man is not to be separated from this union that God has joined together. As He tells us here in our verse, in verse 6, therefore what God has joined together, let not man separate. Now, He will address in just a moment, there will be a circumstance that can cause separation. There will be another circumstance that can cause separation that will not be addressed in this text. And that is death. He doesn't address that. He's talking about the fact in just a moment in verse 9, there can be something that does so, but that's not to be the easy answer, that there can always be separations. Again, we go back to that sense of yoking. God wanted it to be that sense of permanency. When we have that sense of permanency, and I'm not a farmer, was never a farmer, I've watched farmers on TV, but I think that it accurately describes the fact that when these two animals are yoked together, there can be some bucking going on, there can be some contrariness going on, but as things settle down, they're both going to work together to get done what needs to get done. And that, again, is what happens when I have the sense, and we sometimes want to think of this as some comically negative sense, when I remember I'm yoked to my wife, that means that when I need to remember that, she is there holding me in line, and I'm there holding her in line. And that's how that yoke works together. Now, obviously, one of us can break the yoke. But the point is, we are working together. We see the restraints. We see the fact that God does not want separation. It is man who thinks they need separation or wants separation. Jesus then makes it absolutely clear, makes it clear beyond doubt, that there is no divorce for any reason. And again, go back to verse 3, that was one of the points the Pharisees, in fact, that was the most obvious thing the Pharisees were getting at, although they were playing this game of trying to pit Jesus against the different philosophies, their question there at the end of verse 3 was, for just any reason. When Jesus got done speaking, I think they clearly saw that the answer was no. So we establish that. And then we find that the Pharisees turn around and reply in verse 7, and then Jesus will respond. But they say to him, why then did Moses command to give a certificate of divorce and to put her away? They ask a question, can you divorce for just any reason? When Jesus gets done speaking, though he could have said it with one word, he gave them the biblical reason of going back to the beginning. They understood the answer is no. Okay. If you're going to say no, why did Moses do it? And again, as we mentioned earlier, that's when Jesus takes them from what Moses said and does comment on the fact that it was because of their hearts that Moses allowed it. He then takes them back to the beginning. And in doing so, I think he's emphasizing that Moses, and I want to be careful how I say this, but I think it's correct, while it's in law, Moses never commanded separation for any reason. He never commanded it. But what you find is, as Jesus gives us perfect commentary on it, it was allowed. But the fact that Moses allowed it doesn't change what God had commanded when he said that we were to stay as male and female, that we were to stay together, that there was a permanency in that yoking that took place. So Moses never commanded divorce. If he had done so, he would have contradicted what God had determined in the beginning. And again, Jesus makes the point of permitting and not commanding. So what is then Jesus teaching on this matter of divorce? And then by extension, though not addressed here, by extension, remarriage. And we're not going to deal with remarriage much at all. Well, then we come to verse 9. And I say to you that whoever divorces his wife, except for sexual immorality, and marries another, commits adultery, and whoever marries her who is divorced commits adultery. What we find then is that a general law is presented and an exception is presented. He makes the law and then he grants that there is an exception. The exception is if your spouse is sexually immoral. If he or she commits sexual infidelity. And it can be in a number of forms that we'll not be graphic about, but indeed it isn't simply the idea of a particular act, but it is that sexual immorality that they find themselves engaged in. And for that reason, Jesus says, there can be and will be a putting away. Now, let me say here, again, he is not commanding the divorce. I've emphasized that earlier. I want to emphasize it again because sometimes we forget that. We get so caught up in the divorce remarriage question, we forget that Jesus never commanded that a spouse divorce their spouse who has been unfaithful, sexually unfaithful. But he says it can be done. If a spouse can heal and the guilty party repents, then indeed that couple can stay together. That may on the surface seem obvious, but over the years I've gotten a lot of inquiries from individuals asking if they must divorce their spouse because they just found out, oftentimes it's a he, they just found out he's been unfaithful to me. Do I have to divorce him? My answer is, as I understand this passage and others, no, you don't have to. In fact, my personal opinion is that if you can work through it, you'll be the better off. And that's my encouragement. My first answer to somebody who says, my spouse has cheated on me, is not, well, you know, now you have a scriptural right to divorce them. Come on, let's head to the courthouse. It is, what can we do to save that sinner's soul and to keep the marriage whole? And then it progresses from there. So the general law is that whoever divorces his wife and marries another commits adultery. Now, that doesn't have a thing to do with the exception clause. The exception clause, I believe, necessarily sets forth an exception. And that would be that if adultery were involved and you put your spouse away, then you are at liberty to enter a God-joined union. That's the only exception that's presented for us in this text. That's the exception that stands by itself. That also goes to the point that they were making as they were looking at Moses and the hardness of their hearts, what he permitted. It goes to the point that Jesus wants them to understand that that sexual immorality isn't what some were interpreting under Deuteronomy 24. Well, she displeased me. And therefore, that's disgrace, or that's a defilement. No, it's in the realm of sexual immorality, fornication, if you will. And so when we are done with the text, they had the clear impression that God intended a God-joined union to be permanent. You could not destroy that God-joined union for just any reason. It was only because of the sexual immorality of your spouse. If that sexual immorality takes place and there is no healing of the relationship, it is inferred within the passage That is the cause for the dissolving of the union, not simply any reason whatsoever. Something else to note here, and I think this is an important point. I've made it in other lessons on divorce and remarriage, or divorce, and I think that I want to always emphasize this, because there are a lot of people out there that have a real general, real broad view of divorce and remarriage. Even some within what we would consider our fellowship of Christians around the world. What I've never gotten a good answer on is this. To my brother or sister in Christ that believes, well, I can divorce my spouse for some reason and still go find another spouse. And that's okay because of some other passages we'll not look at today. My question to them is always this. Explain the disciples' reaction. If the disciples went away from this exchange between the Pharisees and Jesus with the idea, okay, Jesus says it's okay to divorce for any reason and marry somebody else and everything's just fine, you'll be in a God-joined union. Look at their reaction there in verse 9. His disciples, 10. His disciples said to him, if such is the case of the man with his wife, it is better not to marry. Jesus' comments were scaring them into celibacy. Now, Jesus, though, makes this point, and again, I think this is a crucial point to understanding the weight of the consequences of a divorce that is not truly recognized by God as a dissolving of the marriage that's been God-joined. And it's this. In verse 12, for there are eunuchs who were born eunuchs from their mother's womb. So we have a person that has no sexual inclinations at all. No sexual desires whatsoever. They were born that way. Then there are those who are made eunuchs by men. Many times in war, some particular group of the captured people would be made eunuchs. Because what they would often do is take captives and bring them in, and to make them get into the government and be involved in the government, they wanted to take away the temptation of somebody coming in with sexual enticement and causing them to rob their treasury, or for sexual enticement causing them to betray secrets. And so history says the Babylonians, and others did as well, gave the person a choice. You want to serve in this office, you become a eunuch. And many, many, many said, okay, I'll do that. I'd rather have the power there than the sexual powers that I had before. So some were born eunuchs, some were made eunuchs. And then here's the key, continuing in verse 12. And there are eunuchs who were made themselves eunuchs. They made themselves eunuchs for the kingdom of heaven's sake. I want to serve God, I will become a eunuch. There are those who could find themselves in a position to say, if I continue in this sexual relationship, I can't be pleasing to God. Why? I'm not in a God-joined union. I didn't divorce my spouse because of her unfaithfulness. And let me say this. I'm not talking about what's on your divorce papers. I mean the cause of the dissolving of the union. It wasn't her unfaithfulness. I just got tired of her, and so I left her. And now I've married someone. It's not a God-joined union. I've married somebody. But wait a minute. I want to serve God. Or I was the adulterer. My wife put me away. I want to serve God. If I want to serve God, then I've forfeited my privilege to have a spouse. I had a spouse, and my behavior caused that marriage to be destroyed. And now, for the kingdom's sake, because I want to serve God and I want to go to heaven, I'll remain celibate because I was the guilty party. The spouse is not. And they would operate under an entire different matter with regard to be getting into a God-joined union. But that's why verse 12, and I don't hear a lot of discussion about it, but verse 12 is key to understanding how serious the disciples took what Jesus was saying. And when I hear brethren talk about it as if this were some insignificant thing, yeah, there was this discussion, but you know, you can divorce anyhow. No, the disciples showed that it was something important that Jesus was saying with long-lasting consequences. And so He enlightens us and gives us insight into what God's authority is within the, or what our authority is within the new covenant, and what God is expecting of us as children of God, no longer under the law of Moses, where because of the hardness of their hearts, He permitted some things, but rather showing us that our obligation goes back to the beginning, back to Adam and Eve, being joined with our spouse. I hope that the things that I've talked about are first and foremost, and I say this a lot and I mean it completely, I hope it's in harmony with God's Word. If you think that I've misunderstood something, or if you misunderstand something I've said, I'll be happy to have a private conversation with you about it and perhaps clear up something I've said, or examine it further and may need to make some changes in some things I've said. We'll let that be as it will. But I commit the lesson to you and hope that it is profitable for your consideration.